Let's remind ourselves of a few facts from yesterday that I'll be using quite a lot today. One was the definition of the dual norm on a space. So if you've got a norm, then the dual norm of phi is the largest inner product of phi with any vector of norm or function. I think of vectors as functions and points, all sort of interchangeably, of any function of norm at most one. And then we have the trivial lemma. Trivial basically follows from the definition that the inner product of f with phi is at most the norm of f times the dual norm of phi. And we had a corollary of the Hahn-Banach theorem, a simple corollary of a simple theorem, a simple theorem at least in the finite dimensional setup, that if you've got some closed convex sets and you've got a function that doesn't belong to some of those closed convex sets, then you can find a functional phi such that the inner product of f with phi is greater than 1 and the inner product of anything in ki with phi is less than or equal to 1. And there was a more accurate version of this which involved the lambdaized, but which I won't be using that. So let's just stick with this simple one. Let's just get an idea of the kind of thing we can do with this. I'll prove what you might call a structure theorem, although it's... I'll explain the word rudimentary in a moment. But let's suppose that what we... The reason that you might call this a structure theorem is that there are many norms around where the norm somehow measures pseudo-randomness and the dual norm somehow measures structure. In particular, the UK norms are a bit like that. So this theorem here is perhaps a better way of saying it is a rudimentary approximate structure theorem. So what this says is that if you've got a function f, then you can, and it's, the hypothesis is it's L2 norms at most 1, then you can decompose it as g plus h in such a way that the dual norm of g is not too big. So we think of c as a sort of smallish positive constant. So that's the structured part, and the ordinary norm of H is at most C, and that's supposed to be the kind of little error term somehow. So it's an approximate structure theorem. And the proof is virtually trivial from the corollary of Hahn-Banach that I had yesterday. So it's just the usual thing is we're trying to show that F is an element of a sum of two convex sets. So one of the convex sets is C to the minus 1 times the unit ball of the dual norm, and the other one is C times the unit ball of the norm. So we apply Hahn-Banach, that gives us a functional phi, and the properties that we get out of the corollary are that its inner product with F is greater than 1, and its inner product with anything in this set is at most C to the minus 1, which a moment thought you realize that's precisely saying that the norm of phi is at most C. And similarly, the fact that the inner product of phi with anything here is at most 1 is precisely saying that the dual norm of phi is at most C to the minus 1. And then by the trivial lemma that we get that the L2 norm of phi squared is the inner product of phi with itself, which is at most the norm of phi times the dual norm of phi, and therefore at most 1. If the L2 norm of phi is at most 1, and the L2 norm of f is at most 1 by hypothesis, then by Cauchy-Schwarz we get the inner product of f with phi is at most 1, and that contradicts the fact that it was greater than 1. So it's an extremely simple argument. So why do we not celebrate this structure theorem? Basically because it's useless in applications. And let me just explain why. First of all, we don't actually have control on... I mean, we've got the C and the C to the minus 1. And in practice, we would prefer to have... Usually the structure that you get out of a dual norm is such that you need a much better estimate on the original norm in order for the approximation to count as small. So in other words, what we really need is that the norm of h, remember we're writing f as g plus h, we need to be able to say that h is at most eta of the dual norm of g for some function eta that will come out of some later considerations. And unfortunately, oh, I see why this is doing it. Right. So that's one problem. And another problem is that in practice we often have an assumption like that f takes values in the interval 0, 1, and we really want something like that g should also take values in 0, 1, that kind of thing. So we want to be able to control the ranges of g and h if we know what the range of f is. Now we'll see later on that actually you can get these sorts of additional features in a decomposition. So I'll show you one of the ideas already. I should warn you that this structure theorem, although it's better than the first one, I still call it, when I say a less rudimentary, I mean a less rudimentary brackets, but still rudimentary, close brackets, structure theorem. So this one is at least solves the first problem. We get a strong estimate for the norm of one of the error terms. It doesn't say anything about the ranges, though. Now, with this stronger estimate, we obviously got to pay for that somehow, and the way we pay for it is by introducing an L2 error. And this is a very common situation in arithmetic combinatorics. Anyone who's worked with regularity lemmas and things, you know that if you're prepared to give yourself a little L2 error, then you can somehow arbitrarily strengthen quite a lot of theorems in this kind of way. And so this is another example of this phenomenon. And so let me show you how to prove this, because it's also simple. So let's just suppose that, once again, that we can't do what we want for a particular choice of M. So, in other words, what we're trying to do is write F equals F1 plus F2 plus F3, and we want that and that, and sorry, that's a norm there, and F3 L2 norm is at most epsilon. Then the Hahn-Banach corollary this time will tell us, roughly speaking, if you want to remember quickly what it tells you about phi, you just dualize the norm and take the reciprocal of the thing on this side. So what it'll tell us about phi is that the norm of phi is at most m to the minus 1. The dual norm of phi is at most 1 over eta m. And the dual of the L2 norm is the L2 norm, so that the L2 norm of phi will be at most epsilon to the minus 1. That's what comes out of the Hahn-Banach corollary. So I think I've written that there, yes. So those are the three properties that we get. Its norm is at most m to minus 1, its dual norm is at most eta m to the minus 1, and now we've got an additional, because we've allowed ourselves this extra L2 error, we've got an additional fact about phi, that there's an upper bound on its L2 norm. And so now we choose a rapidly increasing sequence of m's, and just play this exact game for each mi. Let me not bother to say too much about what m1 is, but you can take it through 1 or something like that, but it doesn't actually make too much difference, because you can fix your choice of eta. So once we've done that, we've now got a sequence of phi i's, and we've got some estimates on the norms of the phi i's in terms of the corresponding mi's. And if we use those estimates, well, first of all, we've got that all of the phi i's have L2 norm at most epsilon to the minus 1, so they've all got bounded L2 norm. But also, if we choose the sequence increasing fast enough, we can get the phi i's to be approximately orthogonal to each other as well, because once we've got phi I having a norm that's bounded above by, what do I want? No, we've got phi I star has a norm that's bounded above by eta mi to the minus one, we can then choose the next I to be so big that the mi is the reciprocal, that is much, much smaller than eta mi, and therefore we can get this approximate orthogonality very easily. And so once we've got that they have bounded L2 norm and they're approximately orthogonal, we've got control on the L2 norm of the sum of the phi i's. And roughly speaking, the sum of the phi i's is going to grow sort of like this. But we also know that each phi I has inner product 1, at least, with F, and therefore this inner product grows like R, and then that contradicts Cauchy-Schwarz if F has L2 norm at most 1. In fact, you can see that the R that you need to go up to, so let's just think about the bounds here. Your function eta, you're essentially iterating, or iterating the function eta to the minus 1, and you have to iterated about R times. And for people who are interested in bounds in various lemmas and things, that's a pretty expensive thing to do, but I'm going to be comparing this method of proof with other methods of proof, and the other methods of proof are expensive in precisely the same way. So I'm not going to claim any gain here, but not any loss either. Yes, exactly. Well, the main message, I suppose, is that the Hahn-Banach theorem allows you to do a lot of stuff in a completely unexplicit way. And later on, I'll be just... I'll save up the morals a little bit. Yes, but R is pretty small. I don't want R to be very big. R is some fixed constant. So if I had infinitely many of them, what would that tell me? So the point about this is that the M that I get is a function only of epsilon and the function eta, and not of M. So but it can be a pretty big function of epsilon and eta, because it's roughly speaking iterating e to the minus one epsilon to the minus one times. Now I want to talk, sort of change tack ever so slightly, and talk a little bit about the Green Tau theorem, and see what Hahn-Banach tells us about that. So it occurs to me, I haven't got a statement of the theorem on the slide, but I think enough, I don't know whether, I think maybe the audience has now whittled down to the, is that true? Is there anybody here who's not part of the workshop? No, so I think I can take it as read that we know what the green, So the Green Tower theorem says that the primes contain arbitrarily long arithmetic progressions. It's a fact you may know even if you weren't part of the workshop. So, first of all, I want a slide with a slightly unsatisfactory account of part of their proof, and then I shall go on to a more satisfactory account. So, roughly, the basic idea that they had was to somehow get rid of all the number theory and reduce it to a purely combinatorial problem. So, the first problem that you have is you can't just apply Semmeradius theorem to the primes because they're much too sparse for that to be possible. So they must have had. I mean, I'm not sort of putting myself. I don't know what the exact history of how they came up with the ideas is, but they must have had the following sort of thought, which is that because this sum, as I've been talking about in previous lectures, is robust under small UK perturbations, perhaps you could actually perturb the function f to produce a function that looked more like the characteristic function of a set that was more dense. Or in a slightly different way, you could take the von Mangold function and try to approximate it by a bounded function in UK, and then you might have a hope, well, if you can do that, then my verbal explanation is slightly different from the one on the slide. So if you can do that, there would be a hope that if you just use the general sort of philosophy that UK perturbations don't change too much, and Semmeradius theorem guarantees you progressions if you are in the dense world, then you sort of should be okay. So that was the hope. Well, the first thing is you can't approximate the von Mangold function in UK minus one by a bounded function for very simple reasons, things like that the primes don't contain even numbers and that completely kills you. But there is a trick called the W trick where you pass to a you restrict attention to a sub-progression, to an arithmetic progression that's got quite a lot of primes, and you don't have obstructions from small prime divisors, and so that's not actually at all the serious problem. And it turned out that you could approximate, just as they wanted, but for the moment, let's just use the fact that the primes can be contained. This is what they proved using work of Goldstone and Yildirim. The primes can be sort of essentially contained inside a set that looks rather random from the point of view of the UK norm. Well, there's not actually a set, it's a function that's slightly more general than a set. And this, I just have to think a little bit about this. I don't know what the adjective from arithmetic combinatorics is, so I've gone for arithmetico-combinatorial, but there may be a debate about that later on. So let's see what the purely combinatorial or arithmetic combinatorial problem was that they had. I won't bother to say exactly what a pseudo-random measure is. Amongst other properties that it has, is that it's close in UK to a constant function, but it's got some other properties that you need in order to do some of the things that they did. So you can approximate f by a bounded function. The theorem they needed to prove was, if you've got a function that's bounded above by a pseudo-random measure, then you can approximate it by a function that's bounded. And once they had that, this would prove the theorem, because of the sorts of remarks that I was just making, that Semiradis' theorem in the functional version will tell you that this sum for g, if g is bounded, is bounded below by some constant that depends just on delta, and therefore if your approximation to f is good enough, then you get the same for f. Now what I've said is not quite as simple as it might seem, because if you think of what I was talking about yesterday about those sums being robust under small UK perturbations, all the time I was assuming that functions were bounded. And that's not too hard to prove. It becomes quite a bit harder to prove if they're not, well, in general it's not true if they're not bounded, but what Green and Tower showed was that if you're bounded above by a pseudo-random measure, in their sense of a pseudo-random measure, then it was still true. So as long as what you're bounded above by is a random enough looking thing, then you can still use the fact that UK perturbations you can do UK perturbations. But I, of course, haven't really explained left a lot out, but this is the theorem I want to concentrate on, so let's just take it as read, but this is what we need to, what they need to do. So what I want to show is that the Hahn-Banach theorem gives you a way of proving transference-type results. So transference, what is a transference result? It's something like this. You've got a function with that belongs to one set. You'd like to approximate it in a certain norm by a function that belongs to another set. And the reason you want to do that is that you can analyze the set, the function that's in this set, and if the approximation is good enough in a certain sense, then you can carry that analysis back to the function that you started with. That's the hope. So let's look at a very sort of general transference type statement. So this is this theorem should perhaps I should have had inverted commas around it, because for two reasons. One is I've expressed it in rather qualitative language, and the other is it's not true in general. So what we want to do is sort of go ahead and use Hahn-Banach, try to prove it, see where we get stuck, and see what we need to do to get ourselves unstuck. So that'll be the general program here. There's the theorem again. I've learnt my lesson from 2 days ago. So the statement I've got is I've got two measures, mu and nu, two probability measures on, I'm thinking of, sort of Zn or something like that, and I'm assuming they're very close in some norm. I've got a function that's bounded above by mu. I'd like to approximate it by a function that's bounded above by nu. Now the first thing I want to observe is that this is precisely trying to show that f belongs to a sum of two convex sets. So we're in the sort of applying Hahn-Banach world. So what's one convex set is just the unit ball of the norm, or rather epsilon times the unit ball of the norm, and the other one is the set of all functions that take values between naught and nu. So I call those b and k. So what I'd like to show, no, don't worry about the 1 plus delta to the minus 1, that's just a little sort of giving myself some elbow room, which turns out to be useful, and then you can sort of get rid of the elbow room later on. So I'd like to show that f belongs to a small multiple of the unit ball of the norm plus something in k, i.e. something that's bounded above by nu, a positive function that's bounded above by nu. And if we can do that, that's precisely saying that f is of the form g plus something of small norm. So because that's of the form we want, and both the convex sets contain zero, let's just see what the Hahn-Banach corollary tells us. If we can't do it, then we can find a functional that proves that we can't do it. We can find a functional such that 1 plus delta to the minus 1 f in a product phi is greater than 1, so in particular that tells us f in a product phi is at least 1 plus delta. The dual norm of phi is at most epsilon to the minus 1, and the inner product of phi with g is at most 1 for every g in the set k. And now we're almost done. But let's just think, we're almost done, but the almost is one of those troublesome 5%, so to speak. So the last condition is equivalent to the assertion, yes, that... let's just see why this is true. First thing I wanted to find a g that's lying between naught and nu that maximizes the inner product with phi. Well, since nu is positive, obviously I'll make g equal to nu when phi is positive and equal to naught when phi is negative. And if I do that, that's precisely saying that the inner product of nu with phi plus, where phi plus is phi for positive values and zero for negative values, is at most 1. So let's just remind ourselves what we've got from this functional. We know that the norm of mu minus nu is very small. F is between naught and mu. And we find a functional phi such that the inner product of F with phi is a little bit bigger than 1. Phi has smallish dual norm, and the inner product of phi plus with nu is at most 1. If, and this is a big if, we knew that the dual norm of phi plus was small, we'd be finished. Of course we don't know that, but let's just see what would happen if we did know that. Well then, by the trivial lemma, if mu minus nu has small norm and phi plus has small dual norm, then the inner product of mu minus nu with phi plus is very small. And that tells us that the inner product of mu with phi plus is approximately equal to the inner product of nu with phi plus. Since the inner product of nu with phi plus is at most 1, the inner product of mu with phi plus must be at most 1 plus delta over 2, let's say. Well, if the inner product of mu with phi plus is at most 1 plus delta over 2, then the same is certainly true of f, because phi plus is positive and f is less than mu. If the inner product of f with phi plus is at most that, then the inner product of f with phi is at most 1 plus delta over 2, because f is positive and phi is less than phi plus. And so we got that the inner product of f with phi is at most 1 plus delta over 2, but we already knew that it was greater than 1 plus delta, so we have a contradiction. So the only thing we have to show is the false statement that the dual norm of phi plus is not too large. Well, that's where the extra assumptions come in. Let me tell you one extra assumption straight away that would do it. In fact, supposing we knew that if you've got it, well, this is trivial from what I've just said. Supposing we knew that an upper bound for the dual norm of phi implied an upper bound for the dual norm of phi plus, then of course we'd be done. That's what I've just been saying. Now we can get something that's pretty close to that if we know that control on the dual norm of phi implies control on the dual norm of powers of phi, and also on the L infinity norm of phi, because then we can use the Weierstrass approximation theorem. So what we do is this, and by the way I should say that Green and Tao use the Weierstrass approximation theorem in their proof. So what we do in that particular situation is we define a function j to be naught, well it's this function, naught if you're less than or equal to naught, and x if you're greater than or equal to naught. And now, if we're by our assumption that control on the dual norm of phi implies control on the L infinity norm, we know that the phi takes values in some bounded interval, and so we can find a polynomial that approximates phi. So I'm not really, in this argument, using the Weierstrass approximation theorem in a very big way. I'm just using the fact that you can approximate the function mod x. So that's the sort of basic fact from which you deduce the Weierstrass approximation term. And so, of course, j of phi is the same as phi plus. That's why I've chosen j. So p of phi is approximately the same as phi plus, and is uniformly close to phi plus. And since p phi is made out of powers of phi, and we're assuming that those powers also have reasonably good control on their dual norms, that tells us we've got reasonably good control on p of phi's dual norm. So you could summarize all that by saying, although you can't get, in general, control on the dual norm of phi plus, if the dual norm has some nice properties, here, you can at least uniformly approximate phi plus by something on which you do have control of the dual norm. Now, in particular, this would be true if you've got an algebra norm. So an algebra norm is one that satisfies Fg is at most F times G. And there are some interesting algebra norms around. So already we proved the transference theorem for at least in some situations. For example, if you take the norm of F star, norm of F equals the L1 norm of the Fourier transform, then, well, I think I want the way I've done it, I want the dual norm to be that. So if that's the case, then we'll be done. And there are some other interesting algebra norms that I'll mention a little bit later. Now, Green and Tao need to need this thing for UK, and alas, the UK dual norm is not an algebra norm. So just as though we seem to be getting close, we're not. But actually, they faced essentially the same problem in their proof, and they have various lemmas in their paper that get round the problem. So one of their, I think, main ideas that is perhaps not received as much attention as some of the other ideas is this idea that it would be very nice if you had an algebra norm. You don't have an algebra norm, but you can get away with approximate algebra norms that are approximately dual to your original norm. So the UK norm, its dual is not an algebra norm. You get something that's a little bit like the dual of the UK norm, which is a little bit like an algebra norm, and that's enough for them. So let me just quickly sketch what they do. They define things called basic anti-uniform functions, and they prove three lemmas, which I'm going to take as axioms in this discussion, roughly speaking. So the three lemmas about basic, so I don't really want to say, well, perhaps I can say what the basic anti-uniform function is for the U2 norm, because then you'll believe me when I say that certain proofs are easy and other ones are less easy. So if I've got a function f, its U2 norm squared, to the fourth, is, if you remember, the expected value x, fx, and then ab, fx plus a, fx plus b, fx plus a plus b. Now we can take the expectation of a and over a and b into here, and we can regard that as the inner product of f with some other function of x. And that other function of x is a basic anti-uniform function for the U2 norm, and then a similar sort of thing happens for the UK norm in general. So those are what basic anti-uniform functions are, and it follows more or less from their definition, this first axiom, and all we really need. So the first axiom you can think of as an inverse theorem for the UK norm, but don't get too excited about it, because it's you don't really know much about basic anti-uniform functions. So it's an inverse theorem in that you assume that F UK is reasonably big, and you get correlation with something. But that something is not some explicitly described function. That's what one would really like in an inverse theorem. It's a basic anti-uniform function about which not so much can be said, but just enough can be said for the Green-Tao theorem to work. The second thing is that a basic anti-uniform function has, you've got some control on its L infinity norm. And the third thing is that these have the property that we were rather hoping for from functions phi, that you've got control on the UK star norms of products of basic anti-uniform functions. So I should say that the first of these facts is simple, the second one is less simple, and the third one is less simple still. So now let's use the basic anti-uniform functions to construct a different norm. What we basically just take the unit ball of this different norm to be the convex hull of the set of all basic anti-uniform functions. And you can write a formula for the norm. It's the minimum of the absolute some of the absolute values of the lambda i's over all ways of writing phi as a linear combination of basic anti-uniform functions. I want to show now that the pre-dual of this basic anti-uniform dual norm, I'll call that the basic anti-uniform norm, the pre-dual of that is roughly equivalent to the UK norm for the sort of functions that we're interested in. And one aspect of that is that if you've got a function with small UK norm, call it H, then by definition that's saying that the inner product of H with psi, because you can work out, by the way, that the definition of this BAU norm is just the maximum inner product with a basic anti-uniform function. So saying that, this part's not true. This is one of their lemmas, that if you've got a function with small UK norm, then that is true because the basic anti-uniform functions have controlled UK star norms. That was one of the properties that they got. So since the inner product of H with all basic anti-uniform functions is small, that tells us that the BAU norm of H is small. And so now let's apply that to mu minus mu. So mu minus mu, we assume that it had a small UK norm. This tells us that we can go transfer that over to the BAU norm instead. Now, the dual of the BAU norm has been carefully cooked up so that it has the properties that we want, the sort of control of the norms of products and things like that. Therefore, we can get the transference theorem, except that we've now approximated F by G, not in the UK norm, but in the BAU norm. But actually, that's basically done, because the simple inverse theorem for the UK norm says that if this thing wasn't also small, we'd be able to find a basic anti-uniform function that correlated with it, which would show that this was big, but since this is small, this is, after all, small. So we've got a sort of approximate duality. We're converting to a different norm that's sort of roughly equivalent to the norm that we start with. And so that gives, the Hahn-Banach theorem gives an alternative proof of part of the proof of the Green Tower theorem. I want to say a little bit more about, because a number of people here will be familiar with the paper. So they prove various lemmas like the generalized von Neumann theorem and various facts about basic anti-uniform functions. All of those have been used here. In fact, I think I may have... Yeah. And then once they've done that, then there's a whole stage which fills two sections of their paper where they do an energy increment argument inspired by ergodic theory. So they build increasing sequences of sigma algebras, which are derived in a certain way from basic anti-uniform functions. In order to get those sigma algebras, they need all the same sorts of lemmas with polynomial approximations and that sort of thing. We've got a number of the same ingredients. However, once you've got all those lemmas, the Hahn-Banach theorem is, I would claim, rather a lot simpler. So the energy approach, you sort of build your function G in stages, whereas the Hahn-Banach approach is just this completely unexplicit thing. You say, if you can't do it, you go for a contradiction. And I say that the Hahn-Banach thing avoids some awkward technicalities. Well, let me just tell you what one of those technicalities is. If you're trying to build some sigma algebras out of basic anti-uniform functions, you're looking at level sets of anti-uniform functions. And so you're, so to speak, composing anti-uniform functions with things that are more like step functions. And those aren't continuous, and you still want to use polynomial approximation. And you can't approximate a discontinuous function by a polynomial, except in a slightly weaker sense if you sort of make your discontinuous function do that kind of thing. And that's an extra technical thing that they have, whereas in the Hahn-Banach approach, you just have to approximate mod x, and that's to, and you do it once, and that's it. Here's a sort of complexity measure of the two proofs. When you're measuring the complexity of various algorithms for multiplying matrices and things like that, you do it for a number of arithmetical operations. here, let's do it for the number of times you apply polynomial approximations. if you accept that measure, then this proof is simpler, because as I've said twice now, it just uses one approximation of one simple function. Whereas they have to use a multi-dimensional polynomial approximation and use it at lots of different stages and have cutoff problems and things like that. So the harmonic approach is a very sort of well-defined section of their paper that it simplifies, and then all the rest it doesn't touch at all. It's all just as it was before. So, but I think the bit that it does simplify is possibly the hardest part of the paper. So I should comment that these transference sort of results have been used for other purposes. Green and Tao's work on linear equations in the primes also uses a transference thing, which also comes from Harmbanach. And Tao and Ziegler in their polynomial configurations in the primes have what they call an abstract structure theorem, which is also a transference result, which also follows, right, with minor modifications to the argument that I've just shown you. Do you mean the Gaussian primes and that sort of thing? I suspect. Oh, really? Well, I haven't checked, actually. I think I sort of found found the paper slightly intimidating. And my guess is, by the way, my guess is that again, you have various lemmas that you need to establish in order to get various things to work. Then you can get your energy argument going. But when you've established them, you can also get Hahn-Banach going. That's my guess. But I don't. If there are unexpected problems there, then maybe there are unexpected problems there. I don't. I'm not sure. I just haven't looked into it, really. But I did check for the linear equations in primes and for the Tao-Ziegler thing. I should also add that establishing the lemmas that you need for Tao and Ziegler is, I mean, they've got a very much more complicated set of norms than the UK norms, and it's much, much harder. So the sort of proportional simplification to their paper is a lot smaller than it is for the original Green-Tao paper. One thing I'd like to highlight slightly is that the energy increment arguments were inspired by arguments in ergodic theory. And I slightly share with Jean Bourguin what he said yesterday. Not a dislike of ergodic theory, but just a sort of feeling I'm too old really ever to understand it properly. And I just have to... and I think that the fact that you can use Hahn-Banach somehow shows that although ergodic theory guided Green and Tao, I put this is just an opinion of mine rather than a rigorously established fact. That's just so although it guided them to a proof, I think it sort of shows that the connection between ergodic theory, there's not really a deep connection between ergodic theory and the arithmetic progressions in the primes, because you can just, the bit that was inspired by ergodic theory, you can do it in a simpler way and just say, well, if you haven't got the transference theorem, do a few things, contradiction. I beg your pardon? I see what you mean. Indeed. I know that there are other people who have exactly the opposite thing, that they don't really understand something until they've kind of explained it in an ergodic language. And I think that's just a fact of life about mathematics, really. we all have our ways of looking at things. So as I say, that's just an opinion, but it's based on my own mathematical background rather than a really serious thing. And I want to talk about another theorem that can also be done using Hahn-Banach. It's been done using energy arguments. I want to discuss how to do it with Hahn-Banach-style arguments. And this is a structure theorem of Tao that formed part of his quantitative ergodic theory proof of Semmeraded's theorem. So now I'm going to try and remove the ergodic theory from ergodic theory. However, I should say that I'm only rather partially successful at this. I'll talk about that at the end. I can't get rid of all of it. although I don't have a good reason to suppose that it is impossible, but I don't really know. So I'll talk about that when I've told you what I'm going to do. So let's go back to this question of trying to get a structure theorem for bounded functions, and this time getting information when you decompose on the ranges of the functions that you decompose into. So earlier we've established that we can write f as f1 plus f2 plus f3 with these sorts of properties about the, oh, that should be the L2 norm of F3, I've missed a 2 there. These properties on the ranges of, these properties on norms, and tau seems we've got an algebra norm, so we can get all the polynomial approximations we could possibly want. So let's not be worrying about approximately dual, approximate algebra norms or anything like that. And tau assumes an approximate duality rather than an exact duality, but you can get that from this. So I'm going to talk about the simplest possible case where you've got an exact algebra, a norm where the dual is an exact algebra norm. But now I want to get, I will assume that f takes values in 0, 1, and I would like my structured part to take values in 0, 1, and also for f1 plus f3 to take values in 0, 1, which tau very much needs for the application to Semiradis theorem. It'll turn out that getting F1 to have values in 0,1 is quite easy. Getting F1 plus F3 to have values in 0,1 is quite a lot trickier. So let's see how it works. So to begin with, we'll just apply the structure theorem that I said before. So the one that involved, I keep forgetting, no I don't, the one that says that you can split it up and get as good an estimate as you like, comparing the M with the eta M, and a little L2 error. And now I just want to say, well, if F1, F2, and F3 don't have ranges as I want, I'm going to sort of tweak them until they do. So let's tweak F1 first. So I want F1 to take values in 0,1. So what's the most simple-minded way of getting a function to take values in 0,1? You just, let's do it over here. Here's my function. There's 1, there's 0. I'll just chop it off whenever it misbehaves. So what I'm doing there is I'm just composing the function with that function. So that function I'm composing with is j, and I can uniformly approximate j by a polynomial on the interval in which, by the way, one of the properties I assume about algebra norms is that the L infinity norm is at most the algebra norm, and that you get in interesting examples. Oh, sorry, that's something that you can prove, actually. If you've got an algebra norm at most 1, if you've got a function that's, that took a value that was bigger than 1 and you just took powers of it, it would be unbounded, and whereas the algebra norm would remain bounded, contradiction. So we do get an L infinity control if we start with an assumption that it's an algebra norm. So we can do the polynomial approximation, and we can then get, we can uniformly approximate this sort of chopped off function by a polynomial composed of the function, and that means we've still got control on the dual norm of PF1. Now, why am I allowed to do that? It's not clear. And this is a rather boring part of the proof, but it's possible to show, because f takes values in 0,1, there can't be too much stuff. There's not too much L2 mass here. So when you do this approximation, it turns out that you're approximating by something that's small in L2, and therefore replacing F1 by PF1 is not an expensive thing to do, and so we can absorb the difference into the error term. We can stick it into the F3 part. So the other thing is I've got a it's not quite sure that PF1 takes values in 0,1. It might be in minus delta, 1 plus delta, but you can then shrink it and get another small error term. So that's not a serious difficulty. So now I've dealt with F1 using polynomial approximations. And it remains to get F1 plus F3 to take values in 0, 1. And that's equivalent to doing something to F2. This is one of those facts that's trivial that may take you, if you're like me, get to a certain age, it takes 5 minutes to see it. But if you just write F equals F1 plus F2 plus F3, then we want that to be in 0, 1. So we want F minus F2 to take values in 0, 1. And that's the same as saying F2 takes values in F minus 1 up to F. So I want to adjust F2 so that it takes values between F minus 1 and F. And notice that because F takes values between 0 and 1, F minus 1 is negative and F is positive, so that's quite nice. Right. Well, let's do something very, very stupid. And this is sort of proof by successive adjustment followed by panic emergency measures to make sure that things are okay. So how do I get F2 to be less than or equal to F? Here's a graph of F2. Here's a graph of F. Again, I just chop off the bits I don't like. And well, the first thing to check is that when I do that, when I replace F by the F2 by the minimum of F with F2, I haven't actually changed things by very much. And this is another of these fiddly lemmas. Let me just say one quick word about the fiddly lemmas. They all depend on the fact that I've got a small L2 error plus some bounded stuff. And using that, you can show that but the proofs of these parts are not very interesting. So, and the main idea is the thing I really want to draw attention to, which comes up in a moment. A much more serious problem, because that isn't actually a problem, that this bit that I've chopped off was quite small and can be absorbed into the error term. A much more serious problem is that once I've replaced F by F2 by the minimum of F2 with F, I've completely lost the estimate on the norm of F2. And the norm of F2 was supposed to be absolutely tiny. It was supposed to be sort of eta of m, and that's gone. So I have to do something about it. And to do that, we'll use the transference result from earlier on in the simple case that we've got an algebra norm, so we don't have to worry about the approximate duality and basic anti-uniform functions or anything like that. It's a simple case where... and I should also say that I'm not assuming that either mu or nu is a pseudo-random measure or anything like that. So in that sense, I'm using a more general transference theorem than the Green Tower one. And the reason I'm doing it, the reason I'm able to do that is that I'm assuming that the dual norm is an algebra norm, so I don't need to use so many properties about the measures mu and nu. I just need to know that mu is close to nu in the in this norm. So the transference, well, what should I set as my mu and my nu? I'll just very simply, I'll take mu to be F2 plus and nu to be F2 minus. I'm going to draw a slightly strange picture. So this was F, this is F2, but there's some more of F2 down below the axis. Now the bit below the axis is disjointly supported from the bit above the axis, but it's sort of nice to draw them like this because their supports are so sort of intermingled that when you stand back, it doesn't look disjointly supported. So let's just draw it like that. So I know that the function with the F2 plus over here and the F2 minus here had a very, very small norm. I've now chopped a bit off here. And I want, I've lost the property that it has a small norm, but the transference result tells me if I set mu to be F2 plus and nu to be F2 minus, here is a function that's bounded above by mu. Mu is very close to nu. Therefore, I can approximate the function that's bounded above by mu by a function that's bounded above by nu. So that means that I can do something down here and get and recover the fact that recover the norm estimate that I had before. So I just make a kind of compensating adjustment down below the axis to the one that I made above the axis using the transference principle. And then another fiddly lemma tells me that the mass here was quite small. Now, we're not quite out of the woods yet, but we've made quite a lot of progress. I've just mentioned that the compensating adjustment was also a small L2 perturbation. But we still don't know that the negative part is greater than or equal to F minus 1. But so here's F minus 1, but all we have to do there is just do the same thing upside down. So look like that and approximate by the maximum and use transference again, and eventually we get it. And that proves the structure theorem. So it's slightly more questionable whether that's simpler than what went before, what Terry Tower did. I think it is a bit simpler. I shall conclude the three lectures by making a fool of myself, by which I mean talking about things I know very little about. So Tao used energy arguments to get a structure theorem for bounded functions. That, in some sense, if I understand correctly various remarks in various papers, is somewhat similar to, you can tell me whether I'm on the wrong right lines. That was sort of somehow corresponded to what Brian Acrow and Bernard Host did for building characteristic factors. Is that a... Did Terry at some stage claim that that was the case? Okay, that's... Right, okay, that's good enough for me. So, but may not be good enough for the true ergodic theorists. So that leads me to wonder just if you can get rid of the energy arguments. When I say get rid of the energy arguments, you might want to say that L2 thing that got the stronger, the L2 error argument that got the stronger thing out of the Hahn-Banach was some kind of an energy argument in disguise, but it was a pretty disguised energy argument, I would say. So it sort of raises the question, could you somehow do things over in the ergodic world in a slightly softer way using Hahn-Banach? Maybe there's some very good reason that you can't. I just don't really know. So that's why I call it a wild speculation rather than a serious program. But let me continue in this vein. So just how much I've now given various examples, including one that was not trivial to find, namely the last one, of replacing energy arguments by Hahn-Banach arguments. So the question is, how far could one go with this? And I've got various other things. Various other theorems that have been proved using, for example, regularity lemmas, which are a very standard example of energy arguments in arithmetic combinatorics, where you can prove them instead by directly applying Tao's structure theorem. And since Tao's structure theorem can be proved by Hahn-Banach, that means you've got rid of the energy arguments from the regularity argument things. So there are plenty of examples, and I don't have any feel at the moment for what the limits are. There may well be some, I just don't have any feel for it. So in particular, one test problem is Tao, in his quantitative ergodic theory proof, uses energy arguments twice. Once is to prove the structure theorem, and once is, having proved the structure theorem, is to analyze the structured part. Unfortunately, I just simply don't understand the part of the paper where he analyzes the structured part. And so I can't sort of judge whether the energy arguments are absolutely vital there or whether Hahn-Banach could be used to get rid of them. And I think it's a very interesting, potentially interesting. It would be very interesting if one could do it, and if you can't, well, that's sort of interesting as well. That shows that it might enable one to get some kind of description of what you can do and what you can't do by this method. if it were possible to do that, then this is really the wildest speculation of all. Maybe one could somehow, all the stuff about getting towers of factors and things like that, perhaps that could be got rid of in the ergodic theory proof, but there may be very good reasons for that being absolutely out of the question. But he's got some kind of, you know, successively refining factors and so on. No, he doesn't, so I'm wondering whether maybe one could and just do it all in one somehow. But that, as I say, is a wild speculation, and I will stop on that note.